logjam of ships from around the globe at U.S. ports waiting to unload cargo. If you're going, what do I care? It's not my stuff. Think again.
It is furniture. It's your clothes. It's your garden tools. It's your Christmas decoration. It's literally everything you see in the stores.
Also, President Biden's big spending plans, but how to pay for it. The senator rewriting the international tax code says companies have to stop gaming tax shelters.
I'm not asking anybody to pay more than their fair share, but there ought to at least be a fairness system in place.
And buried in the wreckage following historic floods in Germany, mud-caked bottles of wine.
A wine like this, looking this muddy, is associated more with a treasure finding on a pirate ship.
Turns out it is a treasure. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us today. World leaders are in New York for the United Nations General Assembly this week. Meantime, thousands of miles away, employees of the UN are still on the job in Afghanistan, and there's growing concern about their safety. About 3,000 Afghans work for the UN in Afghanistan. Many fear that they could be targeted by the Taliban for their work. We begin with The World's Monica Campbell, who has that story.
What you hear is a convoy of white SUVs slowly moving along a road in Kabul. The passengers aren't talking. It's tense because the SUVs are carrying top UN officials. They're heading to the airport to get out of Afghanistan. In August, most UN international staff evacuated, but UN Afghan employees, they stayed behind.
Maybe the United Nations cannot help us.
Mohammed is Afghan and works for the UN mission, supporting efforts to promote human rights. This is work that triggers threats from the Taliban.
We cannot go outside most of the time. We are hiding like this.
Many of his Afghan colleagues face the same dilemma. This came up in a vivid way during a virtual staff meeting last month. Local Afghan staff asked their UN managers why they hadn't been evacuated.
There are now 14 people who would like to take the floor.
Mette Knudsen is a deputy head of mission in Afghanistan. She fielded tough questions from Afghan employees. They asked to keep their voices off air for this story, saying it could put their jobs at risk. Many said they had asked UN leaders for months about getting out of the country. At one point during the call, a woman was asking a question and gunfire could be heard from outside her window. Here's how Knudsen responded.
It's very, what can I say? I fully understand the difficult situation that you find yourself in. And I know it must be terrifying to have these people coming to your homes, coming to your neighborhoods. And it's certainly something that concerns us a lot.
But Nixon explained that the UN needs help from other countries to evacuate people. The UN can't just issue visas on its own. The United Nations did not grant me an interview for this story, but a spokesman said that the UN has requested assistance from more than 30 countries now. One female UN employee I speak with says she feels abandoned, especially after she saw a staff email in August saying that the head of the UN's Afghan mission, Deborah Lyons, was going on vacation. That was August 30th, just as the U.S. was leaving and after suicide bombers attacked the Kabul airport. Former UN officials were also troubled by that absence of leadership. Peter Galbraith once served as a high-ranking UN official in Afghanistan.
You can be evacuated, but your job all the time has to be looking after your people, and never mind looking after the situation. I just can't imagine being absent at such a critical time.
And while the UN's foreign staff was being evacuated, its local staff got safety advice. They were told to get rid of any sensitive documents and warned that armed individuals may try to enter their home without permission. In late August, after the Taliban takeover, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke by video to Afghan staff.
The safety of all United Nations personnel in Afghanistan is our top priority. And we are doing everything in our power, namely through the permanent engagement with all relevant actors, and will continue to do so, to ensure your safety and well-being.
Mohammed, the UN employee in Kabul, says he can't imagine going back to work in the countryside. He's heard how the Taliban have ransacked UN offices. In July, a UN compound in the western city of Herat was attacked and a security guard was killed. Mohammed says he's most worried about his family now.
When I think about my future of my family, especially for my wife, for my daughter, the life is restricted for them so much. Even for me also, it is restricted.
The UN says that two of its staff have reported being injured by the Taliban. Nobody has been killed. Current UN officials who request anonymity say that the measure of safety for the UN's Afghan staff should not be that the Taliban haven't actually killed anyone yet. Peter Galbraith, the former UN official, says protecting local staff is critical to the UN's mission.
That is the dilemma that the UN faces. If it's to continue to be present, it's going to need its Afghan employees.
Meanwhile, members of the U.S. Congress sent a letter to President Biden this week, urging him to secure visas for UN staff. Representative Jerry Connolly is a Virginia Democrat.
We've got to advocate for them. We have a moral obligation, both the United Nations and the United States and its allies, to protect those brave Afghanis who, over the last 20 years, worked by our side.
Mohammed in Kabul says he's encouraged that more people are paying attention to his safety. But it's still unclear whether the UN is actively working with countries like the U.S. to get people out.
We are still here. Still we are waiting. I don't know what happened.
Mohammed says he once felt like he was part of a greater global mission to support Afghanistan and safeguard human rights. But now he's rethinking that because he says not enough is being done to protect his own life. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
President Biden is proposing one of the most ambitious spending plans since the 1930s, a $3.5 trillion investment tackling everything from clean energy to early education to healthcare. It amounts to nothing less than a total overhaul of the American economy. The big question is, how do we pay for it? Joining me now to discuss that is U.S. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia. Senator, the answer to the question, how do we bankroll a $3.5 trillion investment in the country? Part of it comes with a plan you have to overhaul international taxation, basically making big corporations who shift profits overseas pay their fair share. Without getting too far into the weeds on the intricacies of tax policy, just a friendly reminder that I and most of our listeners are not tax lawyers. How do you actually do that?
Yeah, I'm trying, I'm such a nerd on this stuff, and it gets nerdy, but the whole nature of international taxation is complex. And this is a problem that we see not only in the United States, but industrial countries all over the world. As individual nation states like Ireland, like Estonia, like Hungary, like Bermuda, set extraordinarily low tax rates, and companies end up saying, okay, I'm going to put my intellectual property in a low tax regime, then maybe put my factory in a higher tax nation like Germany, and they basically game the system. I think most members in both parties are actually supportive of trying to get to a minimum corporate global tax level that all countries would support. The current international tax on the American basis, corporations pay the lowest percent of taxes on an effective basis than any other industrial country in the world. That's not fair.
Give us some examples, Senator, of big American companies that are gaming the system.
Well, there are a host of companies that have big international systems, you know, including companies like Amazon, that end up paying virtually no tax.
So break it down. How much money is the U.S. losing when it comes to American companies stashing their profits overseas, money that could be put to productive use in the U.S.?
Literally hundreds of billions of dollars on an annual basis.
I got to say, 5 years ago, we saw the Paradise Papers. They were leaked, and they showed the world exactly how billionaires and corporations stash those profits overseas in tax havens where the tax man can't get to. There were the Panama Papers. There was a journalist in Malta who was killed because she was getting too close to the story. I may be sounding like a cynic here, but looking coldly at this, one wonders if billionaires are just going to find a way to get around our laws. What do you think?
The ability for a company, or for that matter, an individual billionaire, to hire lots and lots of accountants, lawyers, and others to take advantage of these loopholes is a real problem. The overall efforts to set a minimum international global tax rate four companies. Secretary Yellen has got 134 nations that have signed on to this approach. So you can't play the system of playing off one country against another.
So in order for international tax laws to work, you need buy-in from other nations. Ireland, for example, has had a booming economy in part due to its low tax rate. So they're looking closely at this proposal. But if Ireland says we're not going along with the minimum tax rate, what's to stop American companies from just setting up shop there?
We may not change the rules for every tax haven, but if American tax law says, okay, if you move your IP to a low tax regime like Ireland or Hungary, we're not going to allow you all of those full deductions, and there'll be a top-off tax to make sure that you don't get these unfair benefits. And if the French and the Germans and the Spanish and the Italian all do the same thing, they will cut down on their companies' gaming, because this is a problem happening all over the world.
One final thing, if you don't mind, Senator, switching to your role as chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. We've been following the concerning reports of various government employees being afflicted by unexplained attacks, what's become known as Havana Syndrome. This week's news comes from India, where a U.S. intelligence officer was traveling with the head of the CIA, William Burns. That officer has reported symptoms consistent with Havana Syndrome. How is the Senate Intelligence Committee dealing with this mystery?
This is a phenomenon that the government has been very late to the game in acknowledging and treating people who've been hurt, frankly, under the Trump administration. For the first two or three years, there was an effort to sweep this under the rug. And I find it outrageous. People were being denied the medical treatment they needed. We're talking about numbers now in the hundreds. It's not just people in the intelligence community. It's people out of the State Department, out of DOD. And the idea, if somehow you can become a victim of something that is creating enormous headaches, potentially permanent brain damage, and you don't know what's causing it, we still don't have a fulsome answer on what nation state are launching these attacks. We don't have a full answer on how they're launching. And I can tell you, we now have the resources trying to investigate who's doing it and how it's happening. And I think we'll have some of those answers very shortly, because our spies, our diplomats, our soldiers deserve to get the protection they need when they serve our country abroad.
Well, I hope we can follow up with you when we have those answered. Thank you very much for fielding that question. Senator Mark Warner is working on an international tax plan to be part of the Democrats' mega spending bill. Senator, thank you very much for being with us today.
Marco, thanks for having me.
I want my home to be a personal cocoon of happiness, but it doesn't have to be Architectural Digest perfect. We all know someone who must have everything in their house be just so. The lamps, the drapes, the carpets, the sound system. Turns out less than perfect is actually better for our love lives, or at least for some mammals. Biologists from China and Michigan teamed up to study giant pandas in a nature reserve in China. They found that the bears need enough suitable habitat to thrive, but not too much. Something close to 80% suitable habitat is optimal. If pandas are too content, they may not move around to explore. Like if the forest is really cushy with their favorite chow, bamboo, everywhere, what's the motivation to get out and meet other pandas? But when animals have to set out for greener pastures, literally, they do meet new mates, which is obviously key for creating genetic diversity and sustainability of the species. The findings were published in this month's Conservation Biology. Scientists say the study likely has impacts for other species, too. The lesson? Good enough may be the new perfect. Good news for animals and for land conservation managers everywhere. You lovers might want to take note as well. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Leaders from around the globe have convened in New York for the UN General Assembly. For the second year in a row at the gathering, China made some big pledges to fight climate change. Here's Chinese President Xi Jinping speaking through an interpreter.
China will step up support for other developing countries in developing green and low-carbon energy, and will not build new coal-fired power projects abroad.
No new Chinese-backed coal plants outside of China. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler joins me now to discuss this. So Carolyn, U.S. climate envoy John Kerry said that he's absolutely delighted by this move, which he's been talking about with Chinese officials apparently for some time. The U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has also been pushing for this. What is the significance?
It's a big announcement, Marco. China is the biggest remaining public funder of coal-fired power plants. It's building coal-fired power plants abroad through its Belt and Road Initiative, concentrated largely in Vietnam, Bangladesh, Indonesia. this announcement was really just those several words that you just heard, so it's not clear exactly what it means, when it will take effect, whether it will apply just to brand new power plants or those that are already planned but not yet built. Alvin Lin is an expert on China climate policy at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he told me that if it applies to power plants that are planned but not yet built, nearly 50 power plants are going to be canceled.
If you look at a huge sector like aviation, this is equivalent of grounding a quarter of all flights in terms of their emissions. And so this is a really important announcement, both for the signal that it sends, and also, I think, you know, what it means in terms of those tons of CO2.
What kind of signal does this announcement send?
That China is continuing to take significant steps forward on climate change, even though it needs to be doing more, just like most of the rest of the world. And it gives a boost to expectations ahead of the UN climate summit in Glasgow.
Yeah, how does it change things for Glasgow?
There is starting to be some chatter that the UN climate summit in Glasgow might not be a success. So climate policy experts were looking to the UN General Assembly for some concrete announcements that would signal that countries really were willing to come to the table with some big new promises next month. So out of the UN General Assembly, climate policy experts were looking for any announcements on coal from China, which we've obviously seen, and announcements from developed countries, including the U.S. on climate finance. We also saw an announcement yesterday from President Joe Biden that the U.S. would double its climate finance for developing countries by 2024. So taken together, those are both seen by those reading the tea leaves that there might be some real solid commitments made in about a month's time at the U.N. Climate Summit in Glasgow.
So the announcement from China, it's a pledge to not support coal projects outside of China, but President Xi did not mention domestic coal consumption, did he?
He did not. And that is a much larger source of both emissions and pollution for those who live near these plants than power plants financed abroad. China accounts for about half of all of the coal-fired power plants around the world. They're still building more of them, even though last year at the UN General Assembly, China said it would hit peak emissions by the end of this decade. I spoke to Yifei Li, who's an assistant professor of environmental studies at New York University, Shanghai, today. And he made this point that this is a reminder that Chinese authorities are also up against vested coal interests, just like the rest of the world.
There's no reason to think that an authoritarian state like China can simply change the reality on the ground with the snap of a finger. It simply is never the case.
Still, we are expecting to see maybe some more details about domestic coal use in China as the Glasgow summit approaches. And of course, at some point, more details on what this announcement that came out this week will actually mean and when it'll go into effect.
The World's Environment Correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Los Angeles is notorious for its traffic jams, but right now the most concerning one is in the ocean. The ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach are jammed up with ships trying to get in, dozens of them waiting offshore to unload their goods, record numbers, in fact. It's a similar story playing out in ports across the nation. Lars Jensen follows this sort of thing. He's the CEO of Vespucci Maritime and joins us from Copenhagen. Lars, what's behind this massive buildup of ships at U.S. ports?
In a single word, COVID. In a few more words, COVID leading to the average American consumer beginning to buy a lot more physical goods rather than services. This is one of the key reasons why we are now seeing this massive traffic jam. Too much cargo.
And has it happened before this in the COVID year?
It has actually happened before. There was a ramp up to this towards November, December last year, peaking in January and early February. Then usually when you get into the late part of first quarter, there is a lull in cargo. And the hope was that that would be enough to clear the backlog. Back then, you had about 25, 30 ships waiting in a permanent line. By midsummer, that permanent line had been only reduced down to about 10 vessels. Then peak season came along. And part of the problem here is there's a shortage of trucks, there's a shortage of chassis, there's a shortage of truck drivers, there's a shortage of rail capacity. So when you finally do get the vessels into port, when you do get the containers loaded off, there's not sufficient volume in the infrastructure on the inland side to move it away quick enough.
Right. If you look at the ports of LA and Long Beach, for example, a lot of the ships are coming from Asia. What kind of cargo is on them?
Every conceivable piece of goods that you will see in any store around you. So it is furniture, it's your clothes, it's your garden tools, it's your Christmas decoration. It's literally everything you see in the stores.
So I've seen a few grocery store shelves in my city that are empty, but it seems like this backup of ships at U.S. ports is still not something top of mind for many Americans. How soon do you think this will start to affect U.S. consumers?
If you go down to the store with the intent of buying one very specific item of a specific brand name, you might go away disappointed because that's still waiting in line. On the other hand, if you're perfectly content of saying, well, I just want, let's say, a t-shirt, not a specific one, but just a t-shirt, you will still have hundreds to choose from. What you will find is instead of having 548 different ones to choose from, you might only have 520 to choose from. So if it is one very specific item, you might be disappointed, and you might be disappointed for months to come. But if you're perfectly happy with one of the many substitutes, then you don't really have a problem. Because let's also keep in mind, most of the cargo in the world is still moving.
Would you advise people to not wait until the last minute to do their holiday shopping this year, i.e. start now?
Yeah, if you want to buy that one very special item, you better get it right now. But if you're happy with the substitutes, you won't have a problem waiting.
Lars, I know you believe that things were a disaster earlier this year when there was a backup of 25 ships at the Port of Los Angeles. Now it's triple that, at least. What is the solution to this problem?
There is no really good short-term solution. That's why it's likely going to get worse in the next couple of months. The only solution here is time. It takes time to unwind this massive jam. And the best possible outlook you can have on this is if you're an optimistic soul, you might say this could potentially be back to normal 6 months from now. That would be the earliest time frame to look at. If something goes astray, it is likely going to take even longer than that. The reason for the 6 months is if you go back to 2015, there was a major labor dispute on the U.S. West Coast between the Port Workers Union and the terminals. That led to bottlenecks in the beginning of 2015 that were as large as the ones, at least the ones that were here a couple of months ago. Back then, it took 6 months to fix the problem. And that was in a world where the problem only existed on the U.S. West Coast. This time around, the problem is global.
Lars Jensen, the CEO of Vespucci Maritime and an expert in international shipping. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. 25 years ago, an American musician went to Cuba and recorded some long-forgotten legends of mambo.
I mean, for heaven's sake, people were hearing this as though it was brand new. Nobody said, oh, that's old and crusty and a bunch of grandpas. Nobody said that.
Ry Cooter and the legacy of the Buena Vista Social Club, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Think back to 2008. Things were humming along with the global economy, and then bang, the bottom fell out of the housing market in the U.S. People couldn't pay their loans, and you know what happened next. There's growing fear something like that could play out again, this time starting in China. One of China's largest real estate developers, China Evergrande, is on the brink of insolvency. Here to talk about this is Jeremy Goldkorn. He's the editor-in-chief of SupChina and has spent 2 decades in China as an editor and entrepreneur. The company is now $300 billion in debt, Jeremy. What happened?
Well, it's an enormous sprawling empire. It started in 1996 when Chinese commercial real estate was in its infancy. And over the last decade, Evergrande has gone into all kinds of businesses. So it has what was a health division, but now is supposed to make electric cars. And it's released 6 models, although it hasn't actually sold any of them. It has financial products. It has all kinds of investment products that target both its employees and its customers, as well as outside investors. It owns a soccer club. So it's an enormous company, and it's very difficult to understand exactly what it owns and, perhaps more importantly, what it owes.
But first and foremost, it's a real estate giant, residential and commercial, right?
That's correct. That's how it made its money, and that's still its biggest and real business.
Will China Evergrande be able to meet the bond payments due this week?
The news today was that they have negotiated some kind of settlement with one of the bond payments that was due this week. So it looks like an immediate disaster has been forestalled. I would also say that much of the sort of financial chatter and classes seem to have regained their confidence about the Chinese government's ability to handle this. And I think there's a little bit too much eagerness, perhaps, in the media. We are partly to blame to try and put this Evergrande crisis onto a global financial crisis template, onto, you know, the American subprime crisis, to look at it through the same lens. Mm. And it's a whole different situation, a very different government, a very different market, a very different social situation.
How important is Evergrande to the Chinese economy as a whole?
It's important. It is, if not the biggest, one of the biggest companies. It has got its fingers in all kinds of industries. All kinds of entities are involved, from state-owned banks to, you know, the person on the street who owns an apartment and has put their lifetime savings into a wealth management product offered by Evergrande. So it is important to the Chinese economy, but it is not essential. China can very much get by without an Evergrande. So the government probably has various ways to ease the pain of its, you know, what looks like is going to be either a quick or a slow collapse.
Back in 2008, Jeremy, we were introduced to the phrase too big to fail, referring to American banks that were bailed out by Washington. Is Evergrande too big to fail? And would Beijing help it out the next time it's in a serious bind like this?
I think it might be too big to fail, but I think that the Chinese government is probably going to use this as a signal, particularly to the private sector, that there are not going to be any more bailouts and that everybody responsible is going to pay one way or another for this crisis.
I read that Evergrande has over 1.5 million unfinished apartments in China. Is there a chance that they'll never be finished? And would the buyers lose their money?
There is a chance that they will never be finished. Just recently, there were images circulating on the Chinese internet of an enormous development in Kunming, Yunnan province in the south, that was never finished because the developers ran out of money and they had to implode all the buildings and destroy it.
Wow.
A lot of people must have lost money. So if the government thinks that there are enough people that it could cause some kind of social crisis, they might step in and bail out the little guy. But on the other hand, they're likely to be customers and retail investors who are very angry by the end of the saga.
Are Evergrande's problems a signal of something larger in China, a certain fragility maybe?
Yes, they are. And the signals have been going for quite some time. Evergrande is in the news and everybody's talking about it this week, but there have been signals of, you know, some kind of disease in the corporate body for many years, ranging from the soccer club to the electric car company with six models that have never been produced. Mm. So there have been a lot of signs for many years that Evergrande, you know, has troubles and that all is not as good as it sometimes seems.
I mean, real estate investment has generally been at a gallop in China over the past decade. When you lived there, did you ever invest in real estate, Jeremy?
No, I didn't. I'm one of the stupid ones. I remember in the very late 1990s when the very first commercial apartments became available in Chinese cities and a friend trying to encourage me to buy an apartment in downtown Beijing. And I remember laughing about it and saying, you know, this is a communist country. I mean, I'm not buying real estate. They'll just take it away. But of course, everyone I knew who bought real estate back then or even in the years after that, you know, has made out like a bandit. So don't take real estate investing advice from me.
Jeremy Goldkorn, the editor-in-chief of SUP China and co-founder of the Seneca podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Could we now be at a turning point in the pandemic? Vice President Kamala Harris hopes the answer is yes.
I believe we will all be able to look back to this very moment at the start of this new era as the moment when our world joined together.
Harris spoke today at a global vaccine summit at the UN in New York. Politicians, public health experts, and nonprofit and private sector leaders met behind closed doors. Their ambitious goal, map a way forward out of the pandemic. The meeting was arranged by the White House. From the U.S., President Biden pledged 500 million more doses of vaccines to low- and middle-income countries. Biden also promised funding for global vaccine delivery systems.
We're not going to solve this crisis with half measures or middle-of-the-road ambitions. We need to go big.
Going big has hit big snags recently, though. Moving shots from wealthy countries to the rest of the world has been slow. And in India, home to the largest vaccine manufacturer on Earth, exports have been halted because of an outbreak there. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said today that could change soon.
As our production increases, we will be able to resume vaccine supply to others too.
The European Union has recently announced commitments of hundreds of millions of more doses. The pledges are welcome but are urgently needed. Human rights group Amnesty International reiterated its stance after today's summit. Vaccines from higher income countries must be delivered now. A concrete plan of when and how shots will go out remains essential to ending the crisis. In Spain, consumers have seen a huge jump in their utility bills over the past few months. The price of electricity has shot up to historically high rates, and it's expected to climb even higher. Lucia Benavides reports on what's driving this and how it's pushing some Spaniards to consider a switch to renewable energy.
Barcelona resident Josephine Ekned is waiting until 2 p.m. to get her dishwasher going today. The price of electricity drops for a few hours in the late afternoon when demand is low. Ekner's electricity bills doubled a few months ago. So now, she says she's reorganized her household chores to only consume energy when it's cheapest. If we're paying so much in summer, she asks, how will it be this winter? Ekner and her husband don't have central air. But they use electric heaters when it's cold, so she's worried about prices going up even more. She says they're paying around $120 a month for electricity now. Ekner says she's making a change. She joined a renewable energy co-op. That means her electricity now comes from renewable sources. She says this makes the most sense not only economically, but for the future of our planet as well. Dirk Buschle is with an organization in Vienna called Energy Community. He says renewable energies are, in fact, cheaper and will continue to be in the long run. That's becoming clear right now with the historically high energy prices, which are affecting not just Spain, but all of Europe.
I think we are witnessing right now a situation where we see several factors coming together and producing an effect which in this way was probably not expected.
For starters, he says, there's the weather. It was not super windy this past summer, so wind turbines didn't produce enough power. That meant bringing back old sources of energy like gas and coal. At the same time, the international price of natural gas is shooting up, and because of a European emissions trading scheme to discourage the use of fossil fuels, so is the cost of CO2 emissions. In short, Dirk Buschle says the price for gas and coal is going up, but there are still not enough sources of renewable energy to make up for that.
We are in a transition from fossil fuels to renewable fuels in the energy sector. In the European Union, that goes by the name of Green Deal. I think we would have all be in a different situation right now and probably not suffered from these high prices if the transition had moved much, much faster.
The most expensive part of the transition, Buschle says, is creating a reliable grid for when renewable energies fail. That is, when there isn't enough sun or wind power. But that costs money. In Spain, the socialist government is putting new regulations in place to deal with skyrocketing energy prices. There's a cap on the price of natural gas, and it's lowered some taxes on electricity bills. But that's not all the government's doing. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez says the nation needs to bet on the cheapest energy sources, and that means renewables. José María Yusta is a professor at the University of Zaragoza. He specializes in energy markets. He says Spain has been moving faster than other European countries in transitioning to renewable energies. In the last year, Yusta says hundreds of solar panels have been installed on residential buildings and warehouses, equaling up to 700 megawatts. He says the recent electricity price hike might push governments to act faster. And maybe influence consumers to switch to renewable energy by installing their own solar panels or joining energy co-ops.
Es decir, ya no es una cuestión solamente de política o de conciencia social, es también una cuestión de economía.
It's no longer a political or socially conscious issue, says Yusta, but an economic one. In the end, he adds, money may be the defining factor for boosting the renewable energy sector. For the world, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
Around the time this show went on the air in 1996, music fans were blessed with a recording that captured the interconnectedness between America and parts of the globe we knew little about, an album of vintage Cuban music, the Buena Vista Social Club.
Dos gardenias para ti, con ella quiero decir, te quiero.
This project, recorded in Havana 25 years ago now, drew together Cuban musicians, many of them up in years. It gave their careers a second life. Ibrahim Ferrer, Compay Segundo, Ruben Gonzalez, Omara Portuondo, and others suddenly became newly minted international stars. They spent so much time away from Cuba, out on the road, that up-and-coming musicians on the island had only heard about their fame.
The first time that I joined them on the studio, I didn't knew that was them, because they were more famous out of Cuba than in Cuba.
That's Cuban pianist Roberto Fonseca. He was 21 when Buena Vista Social Club was released.
We young people, we was more about into a jazz thing, hip-hop things, you know.
Buena Vista Social Club would change that for Fonseca. By 1998, 2 years after the album was recorded, Roberto Fonseca joined the Buena Vista Ensemble as a pianist, and that made Fonseca an international star. The Buena Vista Social Club had morphed from an idea to an album to a phenomenon, and in 1999, an Oscar-nominated documentary film. The result, in Cuba, traditional Cuban music became hot again.
The Cuban music, for the traditional Cuban music, will be magical. And we had Arsenio Rodriguez, and we have Benny Moreira, you have Machito, all these greatest composers and singers, you know. But there was a time that traditional Cuban music was wasn't disappear, but almost, you know, there was nothing on the market. And then Buena Vista keep the Cuban traditional Cuban music on the really high level. And that was beautiful, because then people start to be interested about Cuban music, traditional Cuban music.
That old-school mambo even caught the attention of previously disinterested hip-hoppers, like the Cuban band Orishas, with their take on what became a Buena Vista Social Club standard, Chan Chan.
Ahora la distancia quieta. Si de mi lengua estoy viviendo y calmando mi fiel tristeza, ¿de qué forma quieres tú que yo detenga la sangre de amor y patria que me corre por las venas? Generaciones vieja y nueva, de corazón, sangre y pulmón.
That even drew Fidel Castro to embrace hip-hop. You could say that Roberto Fonseca and members of Orishas are dividends of the Buena Vista Social Club phenomenon, the next generation of Cuban musicians dipping into the classic Cuban repertoire. Back in 1996, it was American guitarist Ry Cooder who spearheaded the Buena Vista Social Club project. He produced the album. 25 years later, he's still amazed at the impact.
I mean, for heaven's sake, all over the place, people were hearing this as though it was brand new. Nobody said, oh, that's old and crusty and a bunch of grandpas, and that's not sophisticated enough, and it's not fast enough. And nobody said that. I didn't ever hear that. So we succeeded. I mean, that's what records are for, as far as I'm concerned, is to make music available and have people like it and hear it. And yet it was unusual. So many of them liked it and heard it. My gosh, who'd have figured it, you know?
As Roberto Fonseca put it a moment ago, this music is magical. But at the same time, there are new sounds that tap into the Afro-Cuban roots, like timba. Latin jazz continues to reinvent itself. Hip-hop shows no signs of fading away. In fact, recent protests in Cuba turned the chant of Libertad into a hip-hop anthem for the demonstrators. Do you think the sound that Buena Vista Social Club kind of put on a pedestal, was that simply a lucky moment in time?
Yeah, I think so. It really was. I mean, records are a moment in time anyway. That's what they are. That music from that time has an atmosphere to itself, a feeling, which you cannot, It's not an, you can't take it, it's, you can't go to a museum with it. You have to say, we have to have living people, enough living people who are really good to make this feel right. And that's, that was that moment in time.
Guitarist and producer Ry Cooter on the lasting legacy of the Buena Vista Social Club. The album is 25 years old. A remastered version has just been released. In Eastern Europe, Poland is increasing its military presence at its border with Belarus, troops with guns and more barbed wire. It's a response to more migrants from Iraq and other places showing up at that border, trying to get into Poland. Poland and other neighboring EU countries are accusing Belarus of actually directing these migrants to their borders to destabilize them. Claudia Ciobano is a reporter based in Warsaw. She's a correspondent for Balkan Insight. Describe for us, Claudia, what it's like at the Poland-Belarus border right now.
What I witnessed at the border back in August when journalists could still travel there, what has been happening is that, at least in the Polish case, since the beginning of August, thousands of migrants, mostly from the Middle East and from Afghanistan as well, but also from some other countries, from African countries, even from South America, Polish authorities have mounted a very determined response, which is closing the border. So the Polish government installed barbed wire and they've built what they call a 2-meter-high fence. And they've sent the military in, thousands of troops to support the Polish border guards. The Polish border guards at the moment appear to be pushing them back into Belarus, regardless of whether the migrants are signaling an intent to apply for asylum or not. Then the migrants end up in Belarus. Belarus sends them back to Poland. Poland sends them back to Belarus and so on.
Were you able to speak with any of the migrants last month? And what did they tell you about their experience?
Yeah, so during our first trip in August, the three Iraqi men that we met, they had wounds. They had fresh wounds, so fresh bandages, all of them, wounds to the head, to the legs.
What was that from?
They claimed to have been beaten by the Belarusians, but they also claimed to have been pushed around by the Polish border guards. They were in a state of shock. So these were, you know, men in their mid-30s, but who really broke down and cried, you know, when they met us and they were shaking. And so it was it was really clear they were under enormous pressure. It was like 3-4 times that they had been already back and forth across the border.
Over this past weekend, four Iraqi migrants were found dead near the border. What happened in those cases?
These are four people that it's not like they belong to the same group. They were found in four separate locations along the border. One of the men was from Iraq. He was together with two other people from Iraq, two other men, who were immediately taken to the hospital. They were all suffering from hypothermia. Certainly one of the hypotheses that sounds probable is that simply the people just can't take anymore. The weather temperature, the lack of nutrition, the stress, potential violence that is happening to some of them.
This has been going on for weeks, Claudia. Early this month, Poland declared a state of emergency at the border. What has changed since then?
Up until the declaration of the state of emergency, human rights groups used to be present in the border area and they would simply patrol the forests and the fields. And when they would meet groups of migrants, they would, you know, immediately provide them medicine, food, warm clothes and so on. And now they've been pushed out of the area. So what happens is that the migrants really can no longer get this very basic assistance.
Well, as a result, Poland, a member of the European Union, is now in the position of refusing entry to migrants in need. Has there been pushback from other EU states about how Poland is handling the situation at its border with Belarus?
The response from the European Commission has been, at the beginning, muted, but in the end, you know, the European Commission started expressing its full support to the Polish authorities as they secure the eastern border of the European Union. But I think that it's getting a little bit problematic for the European Commission to maintain this position, and we are starting finally to see some nuance, because basically this state of emergency is a dangerous tool. The Polish democratic opposition is at the moment concerned that the government in Poland, which is, you know, has authoritarian tendencies, might be doing a test run of using the state of emergency right now on this issue that is not particularly controversial in Poland, to perhaps use it later when they are unsatisfied with the results of the general elections and so on. So from the perspective of the European Union, I think allowing one of the states that has serious issues with, you know, respecting the rule of law, media freedom, human rights as well. Allowing them to circumvent these international conventions on the rights of refugees just because it's convenient now, you know, for the EU to block this migration route can turn out problematic on the long term. And after these four deaths and with increasing protests from Polish media and from human rights organizations, finally we start to see some more nuanced response from the European Commission.
Claudia, as for those four Iraqis who died near the Poland-Belarus border, will anyone be held responsible? And if not, what does that tell us about the whole situation?
I'm not sure we have now like a political momentum for properly investigating this. But I certainly hope it works in a way as a kind of wake-up call. I would hope that Poland is not, you know, a step in the further erosion of international refugee rights.
Claudia Ciobano is a correspondent for Balkan Insight. She's been speaking with us from Warsaw, Poland. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Back in July, this was the scene in the Netherlands, Belgium, and Germany.
Record-breaking floods have killed at least 150 people in Western Europe.
The village of Orlov has literally been ripped apart by the floodwaters.
3 months of rain fell in just 24 hours.
The damage was widespread, with floodwaters overwhelming Germany's Ahr Valley, about an hour south of Cologne. That is wine country. Overnight, winemakers were left with broken machinery and smashed bottles of the good stuff. But after combing through the wreckage, it turns out some bottles remained intact. They were caked in mud, for sure, but still drinkable. That gave local restaurateur Daniel Koller an idea.
You have to imagine we had mud everywhere. So we just ripped the bottles out of this mud, which led us to the idea of flute wine or flood wine in English, since a muddy bottle is not a bottle for a supermarket.
No, it is not. Koller teamed up with about 50 of the region's winemakers to sell their mud cake bottles online and use the money for flood recovery efforts. Now the wine bottles are getting shipped across the globe, mud and all.
A wine like this, looking this muddy, is associated more with a treasure finding on a pirate ship, which was extremely unique. And that was what we focused on with the campaign.
It has been a massive hit. They've raised more than $5 million from nearly 50,000 international buyers. Winemakers promise the wine is totally safe and tastes just as good as any clean bottle, though they do recommend scrubbing the mud off the bottle before opening it. Some 400,000 muddy bottles later, Ahr Valley winemakers are practically sold out of flute wine.
Once you have a bottle of this flute wine in your hands, you will get goosebumps, I think, because you will see how intense these floodings hit the wine and how it hits houses, bridges, people.
Fully rebuilding the region is expected to take a few years, but Koller says everyone is working to help each other, and the support from international wine lovers means the world to them. It is now time for us to recork our bottle, but we'll do another pour tomorrow. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you very much for being with us.
From PRX.